The Capital Ideas podcast now features a series hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Through the words and experiences of investment professionals, you'll discover what differentiates their investment approach, what learnings have shifted their career trajectories, and how do they find their next great idea? Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Published by Capital Client Group, Inc.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'll be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour as we look at some of the big stories making the news in politics and business here in Ireland and all around the world. And what's coming up on today's show? Well, firstly, we're going to look at Poland, who has decided that the next phase of its big economic growth strategy is going to be fueled by a big, shiny new infrastructure project, and it's a massive airport. So we were wondering, is it the type of bold thinking that we could learn from here? Raphael Minder, Central European correspondent for the Financial Times, is going to be joining me shortly to explain the whole plan. And Laura Slattery of the Irish Times will be here later in the programme to talk us through that ever more complex relationship that's building between tech giants and world leaders. And then we're taking it all back down to the office with Barbara Power, who's been writing of late about the changing face of officeware and how it's all led to a big growth in the business of personal shoppers. You can email me at takingstock@newstalk.com. We're also open on Twitter at StockNT. Now, for our first item today, we're going to turn to Poland because it's decided that the next phase of its economic growth needs to be fueled by a shiny new infrastructure project. It's a massive airport built away from Warsaw in a former farming area. Now, this week you'll have heard here in Ireland about the new CSO figures about our population growth and also the concerns about the capacity at Dublin Airport. So it got us to thinking, is this the type of bold thinking that we could learn from here in Ireland? Well, I'm delighted to be joined now by Raphael Minder, who is the Central Europe correspondent for the Financial Times. Raphael, you're very welcome to News Talk.
Thank you very much.
Now, before we get stuck into the airport and all the infrastructure things that might surround it, maybe you could explain to us a little bit about the growth in Poland over the last two decades. It has been quite the outlier.
It's basically been a shining example of what can be achieved once you join the EU. This year, Poland is celebrating 20 years of EU membership. As you will well remember, it came out of the 90s, still going through this painful transition away from a communist system to free market economy. And of course, the injection of EU money and the opening up of trade and physical borders with the rest of the EU, particularly with neighboring Germany, gave a huge boost to Poland's economy. Poland is now one of the countries that has some of the best motorway infrastructure. It has rebuilt its cities. It has basically become a very advanced economy that welcomes as well a lot of foreign investment in manufacturing, but also in services. It has a very, very big industry of outsourcing. And at the same time, of course, Polish wages have gone up and Poland is basically catching up. It's now got a minimum wage of around 1,000 euros a month. So, you know, it's no longer this backward country that some may still have in mind from the Iron Curtain days at all. And this of course, has brought a lot of wealth and consumer spending. And Poles, like any other society, particularly those that live in the colder parts of Europe, enjoy traveling. And the capacity of the current airports, particularly the main one in Warsaw, have basically reached close to saturation. At the same time, if we look geographically, Poland is thinking that it is essentially on the side of Europe that is becoming the more important side. The Ukraine war has brought the focus east, and part of the thinking is that post-war, Poland is really the launching platform for Ukraine's reconstruction. So there's also some wishful, perhaps, because we're still in this terrifying war, but there is some wishful thinking about how better air infrastructure is and land rail infrastructure is also key for Poland to fulfill those ambitions of basically being the no longer an outlier, but really the new heart of an enlarged Europe.
Mm. Yeah, we remember their entry into the European Union very well here in Ireland. We have a lot of Polish people who work here, live here, and have lived here now for over 20 years. Their families kind of, you know, ingrained in Irish society, and we have a strong relationship with them. And of course, we held the EU presidency at that time. So it was quite a significant thing. And as you say, they are now a shining example of what accession to the EU can mean, as it did indeed for us here in Ireland. Now, you mentioned there that it has now got one of the most modern motorways across Europe. But the other infrastructural things that you mentioned, like airports, like rail, how has that investment fared for them?
I think there it's been a bit more patchy. A lot has gone on to a lot of money has gone into road infrastructure. A side statistic, but an interesting one, is that Poland also has Europe's largest fleet of trucks, bigger than neighboring Germany. And it's basically been a very, very much at the forefront of road logistics. On the rail side, Poland bought fast new trains, these Pendolino trains, already a decade ago, putting in place modern signaling and track infrastructure, basically replacing communist era infrastructure, has been a much slower process. And this airport project is not just an airport project, it is an airport and rail infrastructure project. So in fact, part of the thinking is that the airport is the final boost needed to make all the other necessary rail infrastructure investments that Poland hasn't quite completed, or has in some cases fallen behind. Not on its own. For example, Germany has, there's been long discussions about improving the Berlin-Warsaw rail linkage. It's still very slow and is not probably worthy of two of Europe's capitals in terms of a modern rail link. Now, on the airport side, airports, essentially, Poland did build a lot of regional airports. Some of them have done perfectly well, have become very important, like Katowice in the south. But there are a couple of glaring examples of probably misspent money, the biggest one being this airport about 100 kilometers from Warsaw called Radom, which went bankrupt in 2018. The then government decided if we build a new runway and a new terminal, that's going to be good enough to get Radom really going. This was all inaugurated last year, and basically it's now pretty much a dormant airport again. Two or three flights a day landing at Radom, that's not enough to make it viable.
Yeah, it sounds very similar to Ireland. You know, we have an airport in the capital that's, you know, over capacity. 86% of all traffic that comes into Ireland comes through that. And we have regional airports that, you know, are underutilized. So look, Rafe, I brought you on here to talk about the new project, but I think to understand both the background of growth and connectivity is very important, because there's no point in having an airport unless you can get people to and from it. So what are they hoping to achieve with this airport? How big do they hope to grow it? Where is it going to be exactly? And how much is it going to cost?
So basically, the cost side, they're talking at the moment of a budget around 30 million euros. The location is going to be about 40 kilometers from Warsaw, significantly also fairly close to another big Polish city, Łódź, written Lodz. And so essentially, if we think in terms of European airports, it's not a lot further than Heathrow is from central London. But it is much further than the current airport, which is basically almost a city airport. And that's part of the issue. The current main Warsaw airport called Chopa Airport cannot be expanded because it's surrounded by housing. So that's why they've had to go in the middle of nowhere to find a location, which is not entirely in the middle of nowhere, as I said, because it's sort of halfway between two cities. And also fairly significantly, it runs basically into the path of one of the main motorways crossing Poland. So the idea is you move the traffic further away from Warsaw, but not really, because if you build the high-speed train, then you can whisk people to central Warsaw, depending on exactly what speed they'll end up with. But let's say in less than half an hour, which by international standards is considered fast for reaching a big city center from an airport. So that's the thinking. And then the other element that they're still working out is exactly whether they will also bring in some, they want to have some military capacity for this airport in case everything went pear-shaped and Russia became not just a threat, but actually took some offensive action against Poland. So there's also this element. The military is very keen on this project because they say it's another platform from which they could respond to Russian aggression.
Yeah, and defense, for sure, as you said, is a part of this, and maybe the rebuilding of Ukraine, but no doubt the activity on that flank in the years to come is going to be significant one way or another. I want to talk a little bit now about the politics of the airport, because Donald Tusk wasn't always in favor of this in the most recent election campaign, I think.
That's right. I mean, essentially, the problem in Poland is that anything that is long-term is hostage to a very, very divided political scene where whatever the one side is doing gets criticized or at least played down by the other. So this airport, the idea of this airport, because the reality of the Warsaw airport reaching saturation has been there for a long time. The idea of this airport has been discussed for over a decade. And the previous government, the right-wing government of the Law and Justice Party, basically came up with a project to do this airport. At the time, Donald Tusk was in opposition, and he went very strongly against the airport as a white elephant project, a way for peace politicians to pocket money and waste the taxpayers' money. And once he came to power, he took another look and basically realized first that there's logistical benefits to it. Second, that it's quite popular, especially with people who live in the surrounding areas around Warsaw. And he's basically come up with his own version, which you could say something like same, same, but different, saying, you know, claiming that he will do it a lot better than peace. There's a few lines, railway lines, that have been redrawn, but essentially he's now taken on board the project that just 1 year ago he called a sick idea. So that's the reality of politics in countries like Poland. And the worry is that nothing will be built or nothing will be inaugurated for probably another decade. They've talked about opening in 2032. Realistically, we know that big infrastructure projects end up with some delays. So plenty of time for whoever's in charge to redraw whatever was done by the previous person and claim that they're doing it again, same, same, but different.
Absolutely never underestimate the power of the politician to repackage and present it all again. Just before I let you go, I wanted to just get a sense from you about what they're aiming for here from a passenger point of view, from an aircraft carrier point of view. What are the type of figures that they're hoping for, and who are they hoping to attract in terms of airlines when it is up and running, hopefully in 10 years' time or so?
So they're basically talking about 30. The new government's project is slightly less ambitious than the previous one. So they're talking about 34 million passengers a year. The previous government had talked about 40 million. Essentially, to put it in perspective, this would be more than the Berlin Brandenburg Airport, which lies west and is the next bigger airport. So it would definitely put this new airport as the region's leading airport. It would still be below the kind of numbers that of passengers that go through Heathrow in London every year, but it would be one of the big airports of Europe. And one of the ideas is to keep basically the national airline, to give LOT the chance to catch up, or maybe not catch up, but at least rival other airlines that are working hard the intercontinental routes to Asia, in particular Lufthansa and Turkish Airlines. So LOT has at this stage really a very minimal network. It has some flights, for example, to Tokyo and so on, but it's the thinking is that it could offer an alternative. All of that, of course, has to be put in the context of, we don't know exactly what kind of situation Russia and Ukraine will be in, who will be able to fly over whose airspace. But in theory, assuming Ukraine becomes again a safe flight zone, of course, if you look at your map, Warsaw is very well placed to cater to markets further east.
Well, Rafael, thank you so much for taking the time to join with us today. Very often when we talk about airports, there's a kind of singular dimension to the discussion. But as we can hear from today, it's about economies, it's about defence, it's about politics. And you've been very enlightening in taking us through all of that. That was Rafael Minder, who's a Central Europe correspondent for the Financial Times. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to News Talks Taking Stock. Up next, Barbara Power on what to wear and what not to wear in the office. You're welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Andy Johnston. Now, we were just getting used to dress down Fridays when COVID arrived, and the need to dress well in work kind of evaporated overnight. Well, the top half of us might have needed to look well on Zoom, but after that, a lot of people sort of reverted to track suits and kind of comfort attire. But now we have the return to the office, and some of us have forgotten what actually passes for office wear, and some people need some help, and that's where personal shoppers have come in. And according to my next guest, there's a kind of new boom in that industry as a result of this. Well, Barbara Power is a former fashion editor with the Irish Independent and now fashion and lifestyle writer. Barbara, you're very welcome to News Talk. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Mandy.
Now, Barbara, like, whether you know it or not, clothes are so important in our lives. And I don't think that's any less so when we're talking about our working lives, because, you know, what you wear says a lot about you, whether you pay attention to it or not. Can you just talk us through how things have changed? Because they really have changed in recent years. And a lot of people are struggling with trying to understand what to do now.
Absolutely. Well, I think things, you know, pre-COVID, things were getting a bit more relaxed, and that was all because of the tech industry. And then in March 2019, Goldman Sachs loosened their rules and they allowed chinos. And that business model took off. But within 12 months then, we had COVID. So where are we now? So writing in the Business Post last Sunday, one of the key findings I found was that the new rule is dress for your day. So you analyze, you know, what sort of day? Is it a client-facing day? Are they in the tech industry? Do I dress down? Is it a high-level corporate? Do I need a suit? You just basically need to use some cop on. But I know there's lots of people out there. They're really sorry that the suit uniform has gone because it makes things more stressful. So what I'm finding is that a lot of people are, you know, they're creating a rail for themselves. They're judging their week in advance. If it's smart casual, the advice is to go more smart than casual. And I got that advice from the Style Bob. So that's Aoife Dunnigan. And, you know, she has skin in the game. She used to work in Deloitte. Now she's a personal shopper and image consultant. And she gave me great advice for the piece, you know, for the older people working in the tech industry, if they're a bit nervous about going too casual, you know, go dark grey jeans, go a leather trainer, you know, make it refined. And she also pointed me to, which I thought was really interesting, an article in the Harvard Business Review earlier this year about the new rules of executive presence. That's EP. And normally that's, the you know, they look at, you know, business corporate leaders look at the gravitas traits, communication traits and appearance traits. And out of the blue, what has come into second position was never there before. Authenticity at 31%, second to polished. So what's, how do you make yourself look more authentic if you're dressing down? You know, you're already nervous. What does that mean?
Look authentic.
Well, to bring some of yourself into your outfit. So that's about, you know, bringing personality. I know in the past, a lot of guys would have loved, say, Paul Smith, you know, with his stripy, scarves and ties, and, you know, they'd be a real topic of conversation. And, you know, I mean, we all remember when Leo Varadkar met Justin Trudeau back in 2017, and he wore the colourful socks. You know, it was all about sock diplomacy. And personally, I'm not gone on the personality socks, I have to say, but, you know, some people like it. But bringing personality into your outfit is a good idea. And you know, early in the summer, I was speaking with Dave O'Connor. He's the style doc. He's the GM of Louis Copeland and Sons. He's dressed more corporates and businessmen than I've had hot dinners. So I would rely on what his view on things. And he says, going forward now, it's about getting the balance right, the work environment that you're in. But he feels that, you know, you shouldn't abandon the clothes that you feel good in. He recommends that you dress for the job you want rather than the one you have. And, you know, perhaps if you're still in a kind of semi-corporate field, you know, not the tech scene, you know, a tie can now be used strategically, you know, to make you stand out from the crowd. And just, be a better version of yourself.
Yeah, and let's start with the men, Barbara, because there's lots of great sage advice you've given us in there, and there's lots of people that you know, people can go to for advice. But let's just kind of compartmentalize the people who are struggling. So I would have a lot of business acquaintances and friends who are in the 50s and 60s, some of them starting a second career, and their go-to comfort place is a suit, a tie, a shirt. And, you know, some people are really struggling with, like, well, how do I fit into interacting with a modern business? But my go-to position is a suit and a tie and a shirt. And I met a photographer friend of mine about a year ago, and he was still wearing the suit and tie and running around the city. And I said to him, why are you still wearing that? Like, people aren't wearing that anymore, you know? And he said, look, I choose to dress the way I want people to treat me. So he said, this is how I want to be treated. And I thought, that's absolutely brilliant. Yeah. But yeah, what advice would you give to that age bracket, 50 to 60, who are kind of wondering, what do I do? How do I manage to ditch the suit and the shirt and the tie?
Well, speaking to the personal shoppers and to Dave O'Connor, what's coming through is that, you know, people want to seem to be relevant, but they don't want to be seen like, you know, dinosaurs turning. Yeah. So you try and move it on. Maybe blazers and sports jackets are becoming very popular. And, you know, sales are way up, certainly pre-COVID. The guys are having to put a mix into their wardrobe. So whereas before they might have had four navy suits, now they need to think differently. You know, be more modern. Color is a trend now. So rather than having just wearing navy all week, you know, be more adventurous, maybe introduce green. Burgundy is coming through. What I found was that shirt-wise, it is still predominantly white and blue shirts. That's what David Conner said. But like on chinos, you know, neutral colours like mushrooms and greys, as well as navy, are coming through. You know, a lot of people very reluctant to leave the lace-up shoe. They're really not a sneaker kind of guy. You know, loafers, apparently, sales of loafers are higher than lace shoes now in some stores. So like there's ways of doing it, but if the suit is really what you want to do, maybe use a pocket square instead of a tie, you know, just still keep it
small, polished, small changes,
find elevated. But you know, a lot of guys do not want to turn up in jeans and a t-shirt.
Yeah.
And, you know, it swung the other way. And I despair sometimes, you know, when I see, like, what happened to irons? You know, just because you've stopped ironing shirts doesn't mean you shouldn't iron a t-shirt.
Yeah.
So, and these t-shirts, people with amazing CVs are turning up and ruining their chances at interviews because they're wearing jeans and t-shirts. Like,
yeah, that was the first rule of interviews, wasn't it, years ago? You look smart, you look professional, you know, everything is well turned out, because people judge you on your first appearance, whether you like it or not, they do. And you could be dressed down, but it has to be smart and clean and look like you've put in some effort, even if it is kind of looks wear or casual attire. You have to look like you've cared about what you put on.
You know, dare I say, things were commented on, like, you know, arriving in a suit, but, you know, scuffed shoes and dirty fingernails were mentioned along the way. But, you know, I decided to go to an expert on this. Actually, I tracked her down on our holidays, poor old Caroline Reedy. She's MD of the HR suite. And I was asking her for advice about interviews. And she said, people usually match the culture of the business that they're going for the job in. So if it's smart casual, then you can do a casual type outfit. But for more formal roles, such like accountants, yes, but law, you know, for senior roles, you kind of have to suit up. You know, a lot of this really is common sense, isn't it?
Yeah,
and
it is.
We haven't left the past behind and turned into this super leisure dressed culture. You know, there are times when you will want to get dressed up. And I know a lot of people who are really sad that the tie's gone out the window, or that it's in the bottom drawer with the stapler. You know, a lot of people, I mean, you probably remember from the Dáil, you couldn't get onto the press gallery if you turned up.
I remember David Norris caused, and I think it was David Norris, caused a huge stink by turning up in kind of those Bermuda shorts one day, and there was murder over it. And I even recall a time where you had to wear a jacket, whether you're a man or a woman, in there. So look, the other thing I want to get while you're here with us is advice for another group of people who I think are also struggling, because just as the corporate male is kind of in that bit of flux, I think corporate females also, you know, want to embrace fashion, want to keep some of their core, want to present themselves well. But there's a fine line as well between getting that new stuff, keeping your personality. And this is really where, I suppose, the role of personal shopper can come in to somebody who's used to dressing a certain way. And small changes can make a big difference without, you know, going beyond your comfort zone and looking like you're trying to look like a teenager.
Well, I mean, the bottom line, I mentioned Aoife earlier on. I mean, she worked in Deloitte and she was saying like that the navy little Hobbs dress to the knee that she would have worn years ago, that doesn't cut the mustard now. You know, for a lot of people in business, it's separate. It's less formal. There's colour in there. You know, at workshops, she finds people say, I've got a wardrobe full of clothes and I've nothing to wear. So I think, you know, whether you pay a personal shopper a fee or you avail of the free services in stores, I think it makes a lot of sense. It's not about conspicuous consumption. It's about going back and finding the brilliant pieces in your wardrobe, probably some great tailored black trousers, and then, you know, adding pieces that you will wear, getting rid of pieces, selling on, you know, keeping fashion circular, either donate to charity shops or, you know, but get advice so that you don't find it so daunting. So like same BTs. I was speaking to Michelle Kirkman there in Wimsworth. They have 8 female personal shoppers to help you out. And, you know, there isn't an issue over budget or you don't have to go in knowing about all the brands. They'll talk you through it. You tell them your needs. Down in Kildare Village, Clara, a helpman, spoke to me, and she was saying that what she has noticed is that people don't want two separate wardrobes. They want a wardrobe that'll carry them through the week with subtle changes. So, and then another lovely one, Aideen McHenry, she has Ruby Ruby on Francis Street. So that's a pre-loved shop. But as she's going out to homes and getting new stock, she'll have Barbara in her mind, she'll have Mandy in mind, and then give you a call. You know, I've a designer piece, it's 5 years old, it's a third of the original price. Are you interested? So all of these things pique people's interest. And so you can avail of the services to say, look, even the local boutiques, I've one here in Terry, your dress circle, and they know what I want. I want piece of Fiat. They call me, it's in. The pieces work for me. I don't buy an awful lot of them. I mean, my wardrobe has changed hugely because, you know, I would have been very much the suit and white shirt person because I would have been covering inquests, the doll, you know, or doorstep, the Taoiseach. It would have been, and you want to look the part. I quite like the fact that now I can walk to work in trainers. I mean, do you remember that movie, the 1988 movie, Working Girl, where, you know,
she took the shoes off and put the trainers on, or vice versa. You're able to do that now. You mentioned cost there when it comes to personal shoppers, and there's two types, obviously, as you say. There's the ones that you can hire and you can pay. Yeah. And by the way, this is all in that article that Barbara wrote last week in the Sunday Business Post. It's an excellent one. She has lots of recommendations in it. But you can have that personal relationship with someone, and almost, I suppose, like the relationship you might have with anybody else, like your hairdresser or something. You build that over time. And then there's the other relationship, which is going into a store and they provide the service and you decide what you want. Now, I spoke to a lot of people who I would trust about this type of stuff in advance of speaking to you. And what is the fear? Would you use a personal shopper in a store? And if not, why not? And their main concern was, well, look, I'd be terrified that they'd talk me into spending £2,000 when I had 200 to spend on a blouse, you know. And that is a fear. There's that, I think, psychologically, from a societal point of view, are we quite there yet where this is normalized to people? And I'm not talking about people who go into Brown Thomas every day. I'm talking about people who go into Marks and Spencers or Dunn's or Penny's.
I suppose the fear, I can understand the fear. But, you know, it's down to, you know, that phrase, buying less and buying better. And I think if everyone had a really good tailored jacket, now, if they can only afford Primark, or, you know, working your way up, Haas, M&S, Massimo Dutti, you know, you have to have your comfort zone. But I think, you know, the personal shoppers, they're, you know, they've got cop on. They know. They don't want to burn that relationship and you overspend and you never come back. It's not that, I don't think it's that kind of relationship. I think they give good advice. They're not going to be leading you off to all the super luxury designer labels, unless your budget, of course, can afford it. I think, you know, we're all guilty, Mandy, of spending far too much on one occasion wear pieces. And every time we open the wardrobe and they're there blinking at us, you know, we haven't worn me for 12 months. And you could have spent, you know, a four-figure sum on it. So, that's where we go wrong. We overspend on occasion wear. And I think we need to recalibrate our attitude. I think we need to, and particularly, you know, it doesn't matter what point stage of your career that you're at, you know, you want to dress for the job you want, not the one you have. And absolutely, I would say invest in a really good tailor jacket. So on that first visit, whether you're employing personal stylist, or you're going in to a store and availing of their free complimentary service, I would say for workwear, start with a great jacket, a coat or trousers. Well, put the money into that and then you can build up and you can go back. But I think, you know, good structured tailor piece, it says an awful lot. And, you know, I was reading during the week about Kamala Harris and what she's been doing with her pantsuits, you know, and everyone was expecting her to wear white the other night for her speech. And she wore a very plain corporate, now it was expensive, custom made Chloe, a navy trouser suit with a navy blouse, matching blouse. And they were the corporate colours across the partners and her VP candidate.
Yeah, I mean, it's still very stylized in the US when it comes to that brand and stuff. Barbara, listen, there's lots of great advice for people in there. One of the things we didn't get to talk about was the advice on the other side for people who are trying to deal with the staff that they have and how to like tackle that issue of how to dress appropriately. So maybe we'll get yourself back someday to talk about that. But for now, we're going to have to leave it there. That was Barbara Power, fashion writer. And Barbara is a former editor of the Irish Independent for Fashion. Barbara, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. Next, Laura Slattery of the Irish Times talks to me about the complex relationship between tech giants and policymakers. That's coming up after this short break.
You're welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, as technology companies continue to grow in influence, their interactions with political leaders are becoming more and more contentious, and more light is being shone upon the relationship that they have together. But how are governments responding, and what are the implications for the public? Well, joining me now to discuss is media columnist for the Irish Times, Laura Slattery. Thank you very much for joining me, Laura.
Hi, Mandy.
This is a huge issue. It's constantly in the news now. We're seeing reports in the papers of how much tech companies are trying to influence politicians here in Ireland, and it's no different to everywhere else around the world. But how would you describe that current power dynamic between big tech companies and governments?
Well, at the moment, it seems that the big tech companies still have the upper hand. I think governments have been very slow to really put their power in check. They haven't tackled what was for a long time a complete free-for-all on the regulation side. And it's a little bit belated now, some of the legislation that has come through. I think where we see, the fight back at its strongest is at EU level. And the EU, of course, has the Digital Services Act. And that's their sort of main legislative weapon at the moment in terms of curbing the power of big tech and social media platforms in particular. But we've kind of yet to sort of really fully see them flex that. And it sort of remains to be seen. This is all kind of playing out at a time of where we can see very specific instances of harm being caused by the distribution of illegal content on social platforms. So I'd say tensions are pretty high in the relationship at the moment. Some business models completely rely on this kind of content being allowed to flourish, which is a very sort of big allegation to make, but it's just seems to be the case at the moment that perhaps even the responsibility that is being adopted by some of the platforms is actually waning rather than improving.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, actually, because we've got on the one side how governments, how regulators are trying to tackle the situation, as you say there, maybe the EU to the fore in doing that. But how the tech companies themselves either respond or don't respond to that is also the other side of the equation that we need to look at. So maybe talk us through what you've seen about the different tech companies and how they have differed in their approach to pushing back or embracing regulation.
Well, at the moment, the big kind of rogue child is Elon Musk's X, because under his ownership, X isn't really responding to sort of any attempts to sort of get it to take down content. For example, after the Dublin riot last year, there was obviously concern that was sparked by misinformation about a suspect, and the Taoiseach at the time, Micheál Martin, he said that X hadn't been as responsive as other platforms to taking down content, and there was also a real issue with even sort of tackling an app like Telegram, the messaging app, and it just seemed to be sort of beyond their control, really. Whereas other platforms, such as those, you know, run by Meta, you know, they probably do put up more of a responsible corporate citizen front. And of course, they've been criticized a lot in the past, but they do have a moderation function.
Mm.
Whereas, as we know, Musk, you know, really gutted the staff of Twitter when he acquired it. So, you know, whether they are responding in the way that they should be, or even that they were how they were previously, it looks very doubtful. And this is why I think, you know, when the EU, you know, slaps a sort of a warning on X, as they did in July, for letting potentially harmful content flourish on the platform, this is where we might see a sort of a multi-year battle between the legislators and Musk, assuming that he's still there at X in the years to come.
And Laura, how did he react to that? You're talking about the EU Commissioner Thierry Breton, who threatened to use all of the sanctions that were available under EU law to try and tackle him. How did he respond?
Yeah, so there was this formal warning in July, but then since then, as you say, Thierry Breton wrote to Musk and said that, you know, the EU would use the full use of sanctions under the law if he failed to curb the illegal content. And let's just say the response wasn't maybe, you know, it wasn't the response that we would get from Mark Zuckerberg or a figure like that. He actually posted a meme and directed it at Breton, and he urged him to F his own face. So I've censored that, but you can imagine what it was. And look, this is kind of, in a way, like, this joke isn't funny anymore. This is sort of the kind of behavior that wins Elon Musk, who of course is the richest man in the world, wins him some fanboys. But it's a very, very serious issue that this is sort of being allowed to fester.
And I think what you've done here is very deftly explain that there's two types of social media platforms that we're sort of trying to deal with. It's the ones like Meta and those who are trying to conform and work alongside governments. And then you have the other ones who perhaps don't care and actually doesn't suit their agenda at all to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think just on Meta, you know, it's still not easy because, you know, when we recently had a threat against the Taoiseach and his family, that was on Meta's platform, Instagram, and it was up there for days.
And why, Laura? Sorry to interrupt you. What's their pushback about leaving something like that up there?
I'm not clear why it took so long for them to deal with this in this instance. You know, I know the Gardaí got involved, and I think this really has sort of focused minds in you know, the Irish government. And there's a suggestion that there's going to be a you know, convening a sort of a super meeting of agencies and other parties involved next month sometime to sort of discuss solutions to this, because it's you know, there shouldn't be any difficulty. There's not much sort of vagueness about this. This was a specific threat, and I think actually, you know, what happened in the end was the person behind it took their account private. So we're not even sure how long it stayed up there, and so it's a very serious situation. And I think it's actually kind of crystallizes a little bit how, maybe in the past, a lot of the sort of the harms people associated with social media platforms were kind of about, you know, wide array of social issues, you know, online bullying and maybe things that are hard to pin down. Whereas now they've really kind of crossed over into a national security angle. And that's why I think maybe governments are sort of treating it with greater priority than they did before.
Yeah, and more politicians the world over and here in Ireland as well are having to deal with these type of threats, some of them more serious than others, but the fact that they're experiencing them together may lead them more towards trying to deal with it. But just to look at it from another point of view, and that politician's point of view, we're heading into a general election phase now, and they are being bombarded by the tech companies to try and help them navigate the regulated system or ease regulation on them in this country, which depends on a lot of them, HQ'd here. Are there risks or maybe even benefits for politicians who start to say, actually, I want to take on these tech companies. I want to hold them to account.
Well, I think there's definitely a risk there. I mean, certainly if you were to sort of go up against, Elon Musk personally, you could, as you know, end up the sort of on the receiving end of a meme, which, you know, you may brush off, but it may influence a certain cohort of the electorate as well. So I suppose you just have to weigh up those kind of image issues. But I think a lot of people are actually very, very distressed by the role of social media in our lives, and they can see that the damage it's doing. So maybe a politician that gets tough on social media, would actually win respect. And also, you know, yeah, to sort of almost prove the opposite point, to show that Ireland isn't, you know, isn't dependent on these companies.
Yeah, that just because they're here doesn't mean that we're lax in trying to deal with them.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, I think, you know, some people would argue, and I have a lot of sympathy with the argument that some of the regulations that we've been talking about recently through the media regulator, Commissioner Naman, maybe don't go far enough, that there was a kind of a missed opportunity there to sort of look at, in particular, this issue of kind of toxic recommendations of content. So this is the algorithm, basically. And there could have been perhaps a stronger position, you know, in Ireland on that. But now it may be that, you know, it is just better dealt with at EU level. But I suppose that does raise, make some people feel a little bit cynical about you know, the approach that it's been taken so far.
One of the things you touched on earlier was the effect of all of this on the tech companies themselves. And obviously, at the end of the day, they're all trying to be profitable. They're all trying to make money from advertising. And we look at Elon Musk, since he took over from Jack Dorsey, who was trying to, I think, work on moderation to the best of their ability, certainly had a lot more people in place to do that and systems. Elon Musk came in with a look, I want a town hall that's a free space for people to have their views. But the toxicity that has emerged since then, what has that done to the advertising and usership? Is that a word? Usership of the platform, since you've obviously been watching this for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, they're both. I mean, you know, usage is down, and the advertising has completely collapsed, and I think really it's almost unprecedented what's happened here, because, you know, if you think about it, Elon Musk bought Twitter for $44 billion. And something of that scale, you know, in the past, we've had business failures that of in that order that, you know, that have been the result of fraud or the result of just complete, you know, complete collapse due to external influences. But this is, it seems to me,
this is self-determined. Yeah, this is self-inflicted.
It's self-sabotage.
Yeah.
And yeah, for sure. Yeah. And it seems to be, you know, it's ideological. It's not just that he didn't want to pay for what was, you know, already, you know, an uphill battle of a moderation unit, you know, for all social media platforms. It's always, you know, they could never really sort of deal with the scale of this, and make money at the same time. But he just hasn't. It doesn't really seem to try. So I don't know what the end game is.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's obviously lenders involved, and it may well be that there's a point in which you know, they take a greater role in this, or he may give up. I know some people are predicting that this, you know, this election in the US, the presidential election, you know, may well be the last one in which X has any role, in which X exists in its current form. I mean, a lot of people would probably like a sort of a dusty old conservative bank to come in and rename it Twitter.
Yeah.
And, you know, bring in, I suppose, a bit more of the moderation that and old sort of simple chronological feeds that, you know, made it popular in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. It certainly seems like a lot of the people who we would have joined for to hear from them and be kept up to date have gone. So look, we'll watch this space with interest, as they say. Laura Slattery, thank you so much for joining me today. That was Laura Slattery, media columnist with the Irish Times.
Thanks.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock, folks. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app. I want to thank my guests, as always, for their very valuable time and insights. Thanks also to the producer of Taking Stock, John Fardy. Stephen Daunt was on research and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Anton is up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots, lots more. But for now, from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin on the Capital Ideas podcast. Investment professionals reveal how they find their next great idea, what gives them their investment edge, and a few personal stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Capital Client Group, Inc.